welcome our next speaker, Lizzie Peanut from Leeds Metropolitan University. And she's going to talk about phonological representation in course materials. Okay, let's welcome Lizzie.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody, all four of you. As our host said, my name is Lizzie Pinard, and I'm here today from Leeds Metropolitan University, and I'm doing an MA in English Language Teaching with Integrated Delta there. So today, I'd like to talk to you about my research project, which I did as part of a research module on my course. And the topic, as you can see, is phonological representation in course materials. Whose English is it? So I'd like to start by asking you a question. I want you to think about the general English course book that you've used most recently in the classroom as a teacher or otherwise as a learner. And if you haven't already, introduce yourself to somebody sitting near you and tell them what is the most recent general English course book that you've used. What type of English is the most prominently used model in that book?
What do you mean?
What type of English? American English, British English, a different variety altogether? Mm. What is it? So again, tell the person. Okay, so hands up if in your course book the most prominent accent was British English. Hands up if American English. Hands up if something else altogether. Okay, and one more question. Do you think that in the context where you were using that book, whether learning or teaching, that model of English was an appropriate model of English for you or for your learners? All right, I'm going to have to stop you there because obviously we don't have too much time.
Thank you for asking.
So, hands up if you think that the model was appropriate.
I think so.
Okay, hands up if you think it wasn't appropriate. Okay, interesting. So, many people would argue that in the world of today, where English is used as a language of wider communication, as an unmarked choice between many non-native speakers of English, that it's no longer appropriate to use a model that's based on native speaker intuition, linguistic imperialism, and prejudice, that it's time for a lingua franca core, and that should be based on the communicative needs of non-native speakers. However, not everybody agrees with this. Some people would argue, like Timmis 2002, that it's not appropriate, of course, to foist native speaker norms onto students for whom it's not at all relevant and doesn't match their wants or needs, but it's also not appropriate to offer students a target which does not meet their aspirations. So these are two kind of opposing ends of the spectrum of arguments. Of course, there are many positions in between, like a slightly less extreme. And this is the kind of background against which my study takes place, really. You know, the debate rages on, and that's the background. So now, John Gray, in 2010, published a survey of course books, and the most recent book within that survey, he surveyed a range of books, the most recently published one was New Headway Intermediate, and that was published in 2003. And he says of this course book that the RP cluster of accents continues to predominate and continues to be privileged. Now, 2 years later than that, Cutting Edge Intermediate was published. And I've used both Cutting Edge Intermediate and New Headway Intermediate quite extensively, and so I thought it would be interesting to see if Cutting Edge Intermediate showed any developments compared to New Headway Intermediate in terms of reflecting, you know, the debate that's going on in applied linguistic circles. And I thought, you know, this would be a relevant thing to look at because course books are kind of a link between kind of world of theory and principles and what's happening in the classroom. So if we look at what's going on in course books, we can maybe identify dominant trends. We can see, you know, what of all the research and ideas is actually filtering through to the chalk face. And I decided, yeah, to look at phonological representation because, of course, accent and identity are very strongly linked. So I thought that would be a more meaningful element to focus on than, for example, images or text, which are quite a lot more superficial. Now, the methodology that I used content analysis, and I used John Gray's framework, and I did this for a couple of reasons. First of all, because I wanted to compare my findings with cutting-edge intermediate with Gray's findings for new headway intermediate. So using that framework allows me to do that directly and easily. And then also, in using that framework, my small project, which is just a little snapshot, one coursebook, can then be added to a growing body of research within applied linguistics. So this is the framework. Now, as you can see, it divides into four categories. So the RP and modified RP. And RP is standard British English with no regional features. It has been in the past considered a prestige accent, less so now, and associated mostly with the south of England. Then regional UK accents is accents within the UK that do have marked features. And then we have international inner circle and outer and expanding circle. And these, of course, are based on Kakaru's circle of English. So the inner circle is so-called native-speaking countries of English. So United States, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and United Kingdom. But in this case, we're considering United Kingdom separately, so hence the international bit. Outer and expanding circle. Outer circle is the 44 or so countries where English plays an official role. And expanding circle is where it does not play an official role, it's not a second language, it's used purely as a lingua franca. Okay, so you can see we're looking at the total number of units. So in cutting edge intermediate, there are 12 units. And so we're looking at the total number of units where the accent appears, number of units where it appears on its own with no other accents displayed in that unit, and then the number of units where it occurs alongside other units. So before I show you the results, again, with the person sitting next to you, predict what you think they might be for cutting edge intermediate. So out of 12 units, so out of 12, what do you think the scores might be? Okay, so did you get that? Anything along those lines? So as you can see, RP appeared in all 12 of the 12 units and exclusively in two of the units, which happened to be the last two units of the book, whatever that may mean. But we can also see that with all the other categories, they're quite evenly balanced. Compared with new headway intermediate, whereas you can see, again, we have RP appearing in all of the units, but we have a much heavier representation also of the regional accents and the international inner circle accents as compared with the outer and expanding circle accents. So it's a lot heavier on the inner circle, the British, and the regional. So, as I mentioned, predominance of RP features very strongly. And also another thing that I noticed in analysing my results is that the RP accent was used in all positions of control. So where there was an interview, the interviewer would have an RP accent. So the person managing the interaction always had an RP accent. And also for the pronunciation activity models, they were exclusively RP, as were the real life sections. So in cutting edge, not in all of the units, but most of them, there is a real life section. And whenever there was a listening recording associated with that section, it was RP. And then there was an interesting incidence of an expanding circle speaker with an RP sounding accent. And this is something that John Gray also noticed in New Headway Intermediate, an instance of this occurring. So it was quite interesting that the same thing occurs in Cutting Edge. And I found this out because the first time when I listened to the recordings, I listened to all of them without looking at the course book, just listening and categorized everything. And I'd assumed this person just was another RP speaker. And then when I then looked at the course book and listened while looking at the course book identified that person as being from an expanding circle country. But of course, if we're teaching learners RP, and you know some of them are going to be successful in approximating it, then maybe that's not so surprising. I don't know. Then, there was in one of the units a speaking task based on negotiating for lottery money, lottery funding. And within the listening model for that, there was an imaginary English-speaking country, and there were all kinds of representatives of like a children's hospital, a university, manager of a petrol company, these kind of organizations. And they all had RP accents, so even imaginary countries apparently speak with RP. However, also notice that expanding circle speakers enjoyed longer terms in cutting-edge intermediate when compared with new headway intermediate, where Gray notes that most of the terms are quite short. Whereas, yeah, in cutting-edge intermediate, they were all longer, and except for the one, and there they were of equal length. And of course, as you mentioned earlier, there's also less imbalance between the international inner circle and the expanding and outer circles in terms of representation. But of course, the results don't exist in a vacuum. So what does it all mean? You know, is it part of the native speaker agenda, as we mentioned with the Jenkins quote at the beginning of the talk? Is it linguistic imperialism and propagating the idea of native speaker superiority and all this kind of thing? Or is it something to do with what learners want? Is what learners want what's in the course books? Questionable, because learners don't usually get to choose their course books. They're usually put upon them by, in some cases, teachers. Teachers may be fortunate enough to have a choice, but most often at institutional level is where the decisions for that will be made. And those decisions may be influenced by decisions made at policy and planning level in the government. So there's a lot of competing factors. And then, whoa. Okay. Teachers' needs. Well, John Gray, in his study, spoke to teachers about their attitudes towards this, and English as an international language, and how suitable it is to use RP as a model. But he found that the teachers recognize that it's problematic to use models like the British English, RP, and so on. However, they weren't sure, you know, what would be a suitable alternative, because, you know, if you're going to teach, for example, English as an international language or English as a lingua franca, you know, somebody's got to then define all the standards of this. And who's going to do that? And if they do that, you know, whose international English is it? Is it just that person? The country where they come from, is that their international English? How does that relate to all the other people in all the other countries using it? So it's quite difficult to establish what the alternative should be in terms of choice of a variety. You might perhaps think that you could use a variety that's widely used in the region. So for example, if you're teaching in Central Africa, you might use models of English spoken in that region, for example. That's another alternative. So yeah, this, as we were saying, relates to the difficulties of identifying an alternative. And of course, we have to consider the publisher's agenda, because at the end of the day, money talks. So where the money is what's going to come in the course books. Obviously, you know, theories and principles and so on are going to come into it, you would hope. You know, teachers' needs, learners' needs and so on are going to come into it, influenced, of course, by the policy and planning, as I said. But ultimately, wherever the money is probably what's going to be coming in the course books. So basically, my research project for me unearthed a lot more questions than it answered. Although, of course, I managed to answer my original question about have there been developments. Yes, there have, with the longer speaker terms and the more balance in representation. But there's a lot more questions about, you know, what is actually going on. So, in conclusion, yes, the times are very slowly changing, as seen in all the developments. I think now what would be interesting to do would be to analyse the new cutting-edge intermediate that's been very recently published. I saw it at IA TEFL earlier this year in the publisher stands, newest thing, you know, all very shiny. To see now, if you analyse that with the same framework, what developments would there be, if any? And would they be reflecting all the debates going on in applied linguistic circles or not? And then it would also be interesting to analyse similarly again global course books that have been successful, like Global Innovations, so on, course books like that, which have been widely successful, widely used, and see how the publishers there have answered all the questions that we looked at in the discussion. How have they approached it? And now, of course, finally, to bring this with some application to the classroom, if you do the content analysis, which I recommend, because you can then establish, you know, really, truly, is your course book appropriate or not for your context? If you decide that the course book isn't appropriate for the context, you know, after the analysis, then what can you do? Well, I'd recommend, if you think your learners would benefit more from learning features of English as a lingua franca in terms of pronunciation, then get hold of Robin Walker's book, Teaching the Pronunciation of English as a Lingua Franca, which was published by Oxford, because that contains lots of different ideas for how to adapt your current materials and bring in English as lingua franca samples. He even gives a CD in the book which has some samples on it that you can use. Okay, so these are the references I used in the talk. But don't worry, you don't have to write them all down now because I'm going to put them on my website, and this will be the link. And these are my contact details, so if you want to contact me, then feel free, and I can send you the write-up of my research, if you wish. I also have business cards. If you want my contact details, that's fine. You can come and get them. And other than that, thank you for listening. And if you'd like to ask any questions, now'll be the time.
Thank you. Any questions? Comment? Yes, please. Casey, I really enjoyed the talk. It was interesting. You covered a lot of ground. Can you go back to the result you had for the signs are changing and the idea that you have longer speaker turns and the fact that even now, even in the expanding circles, you would have them represented by somebody using RP? I mean, have you looked at power differentials and English as a gatekeeping thing? Because whether you're talking about its outer circle or expanding circle, English is increasingly being used, because it's a lingua franca, it's being used to perpetuate certain systems. And RP, I mean, you have to look at accent image as well, and RP represents a certain amount of sophistication. Like, for example, in Pakistan, that's very rich.
Yeah.
English, access to English is differential. Even though it's our second language and it's our official language, you would have English is not just about speaking English, it's the variety and accent of English. So you could, for example, I could tell just by the way somebody's speaking English what their socioeconomic and cultural background is. So from that point of view, the RP would not just be the publisher's agenda or even the native speaker agenda. It's the agenda of the elite. I mean, I don't know what you're saying.
It has definitely got a very gatekeeping role, obviously in higher education, for example.
Exactly.
You know, you can't, a lot of the subject sciences, everything is disseminated in English, so if you can't do that, then how great ideas you might have are going to be stifled. So yeah, definitely that's got a big role to play in it.
And I think that would feed back into what learners want, because it's really all about being successful. So it's about delivering the goods and whatever you think will sell the most.
Yeah.
Any other questions? No? Comments? I have one. I also want to ask one about the contributions, in terms of the contributions. Who do you think can benefit the most from your study? Like the material or designer or teacher?
Well, I think the idea of doing content analysis is something that any teachers could quite easily do by using an existing framework, as I did, applying it to the materials that you're using, whatever they are, and seeing what comes out of that, what you find, investigating it, and then if you're using it in a particular context, adapting it so that it better suits the context in whichever way that might be.
So you think teachers might benefit more?
Yeah.
Okay. See. So, any other questions?
Yes. Do you have your personal preference in terms of what should be the model for, what English should be the model for the materials, for the books?
I think it entirely depends on the context and on the learner's needs and aspirations and what they want, and it depends on, you know, I think a major model for learners is going to be whoever's teaching them. So, like for example, if I'm teaching a group of learners, then my English will be one model for them that they'll hear quite a lot, as well as all the listening recordings and so on. So, you know, whoever the teacher is and wherever they're from, that model of English is going to obviously play quite a major role. And beyond that, how it's supplemented should reflect, what the learners need and what they want, I think.
So how about the cultural issues? Have you considered this part when you analyze the course materials?
In what sense?
Cultural issues. Like, for example, when I taught English, for example, there are different cultures between my country and the English-speaking countries.
Mm-hmm.
And that will influence the way how they design the materials, for example. So when you analyze the materials, have you looked at this part, the cultural part?
For this study, study, I only analyzed the phonological representation.
Okay.
But I have looked into the whole cultural side of things a bit, but for a different module, doing different things, but not in terms of this study.
Okay, so it's mainly focusing on the
It's just a very small scale project.
Oh, I see, I see. So how long did you spend on, I mean, when you analyze it, how long is it?
Well, I came back, I'd listen to it and then come back to it again. So it took like a lot of listening to it repeatedly and then thinking about it, going back to the literature, reading around it, and then coming back to it again, going backwards and forwards between it to try and link it together, see what's going on.
Okay, any other questions, comments? Still can have like two more questions, and then we can go to the coffee. Yes.
Are you thinking of taking this research into PhD level?
I'd like to do a PhD. I don't know if specifically on this, but I don't know. PhD is not in quite imminent plan. I'm just coming to the end of my MA, and then hoping to go back into work for a while, get some more experience, and decide what I'm really, really interested in, and then come back and do a PhD somewhere.
Thank you. So, can I ask you something?
Uh-huh.
Okay, supposing you have the content analysis of textbooks, where does it really get you at the end of the day? How would it contribute to research? Because I see this going back again to sort of sociolinguistics and Philip's whole stance about, you know, predominance of English and English being everything that's been, you know, in the idea of language dominance.
Yeah.
I mean, where, what contribution would this research make to us as teachers? I'm just curious.
Well, if you either look at studies of materials that you're using or do the studies yourselves, then you're better informed about what's in your materials. So that gives you more choices of how to use it.
Okay.
Because if you're not quite aware of what's going on in your materials, then
So you're looking at the teaching perspective. I was thinking about this in sort of a more political sort of, you know. At some point, I think that ELT practitioners are going to have to take some kind of stance about how far we're willing to let the market, for example, dictate what we teach, how we teach, what we're willing to teach. I mean, we've sort of thrown ideals and everything out the window. And like you said, money talks. So we kind of go wherever the money goes and we stop being, I don't know.
Well, this is the thing. If you have the course, like the publisher disseminates the course book, the institution puts the course book in your hand and says, there you go.
Yeah, exactly.
Then if you just blindly use it and don't think about it, you just teach what's in it unquestioningly, then you're propagating that. Whereas if you do some content analysis, question it, question what's in there, not even just from the phonological representation point of view, but even the theories and principles of language, of learning, of teaching that are in there, do they match up with your beliefs? What you think your learners need,
so
then you can.
So this project has potential for teacher agency. That's what we're talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
Any more questions?
No.
No. Okay. Thanks again for Lily's talk.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for coming.